Matthew McConaughey is going to drunk drive his car into the team bus or something like that before the national championship season. There's just no way. Something's going to happen.
He's gonna get drunk and like turn Bevo loose on on the field and gore half the team to death.
This is one of those times I'm really glad I have no idea what you're talking about.
So Matthew McConaughey is an actor. He's been in some stuff.
This is Normal Men, a podcast from four men who are clinging desperately to normalcy in an era when that's asking a bit too much. I'm George in Charlotte.
This is Propter Malone in Washington, D.C.
I'm low-tech speedrun enjoyer in outer Florida.
I'm Ed from Boston.
Yeah, Bevo is a bull.
Okay.
Matthew McConaughey, also big Texas guy. I don't know if this is something you're aware of.
It's not, because I try not to think about celebrities' existence.
Well, Bevo is the bull that is associated with the Texas football program.
Okay, so. I immediately like this bull more than I like Matthew McConaughey.
I mean, Matthew McConaughey is kind of the celebrity associated with the Texas football program, so.
That's unfortunate.
The nice thing about Matthew McConaughey as a celebrity who's into Texas is that he's also into MLS. He's part owner of the MLS team there. So he's like me. He's like the MLS college football sicko overlap, which is great. I feel a lot of kinship with the man.
You're not selling me on this, George.
I feel like we should note that Bevo the cow did try to kill Ugga the 86th or whatever that fucking dog's name is.
Yeah.
I mean, I would too, right? Like, imagine being a bull and that little skin folded freak is bothering you.
That's not like a real dog, though. That's like,
it's a bulldog. They have an actual bulldog that they have on the sideline of games.
I didn't stutter. That's like a handbag eligible for promotion to cat. No, real dogs. You've seen what a real dog is. I post them on Blue Sky.
I always feel terribly for that dog because they bring it down onto the field and they put it in that crate.
I thought you were talking about Ed's dog.
Well, those
I also feel terribly for that dog for totally different reasons.
Yeah, well, one of those dogs is currently Jackson Pollock in the backyard, so you should feel sorry for me.
It does rain in Boston, right?
Are we recording right now?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the recording schedule has been a little bit choppy this week because mostly because one of Ed's dogs has diarrhea. So
the first one was George.
It's a combination of Ed's dog has diarrhea and my priorities are diarrhea, that which is to say Charlotte FC played on Sunday, so we couldn't record when we normally record.
That was a terrible segue, but I'll allow it.
I mean, look, they I'm can't a man all be in my mid-30s who's really into pro soccer. It's a bad scene. It's a bad scene.
Yeah, you, when you're right, you're right.
Who was Charlotte getting rinsed by this time?
We beat New York Red Bulls 1-0, thank you very much. And we've won 7 straight in the league, which is easily the longest win streak this year for any team. So you can take that back.
Are they still calling themselves the Red Bulls?
Yeah.
Seriously? Oh, yeah.
Red Bull used to sponsor absolutely everyone. I don't know if I've told this story, but I used to have a Red Bull fridge in the back of my office for streaming purposes.
Ooh.
Yeah, for a while.
Are you saying you were sponsored by Red Bull?
I was partnered with Red Bull. They don't give sponsorships to everyone, George.
Ah, okay. No,
but like we used to deal with them, and like they were very nice. The problem is you weren't allowed to drink anything else on stream, and do you know how long those go? 4 hours, nothing but Red Bull.
The move there is you just dump some of them out and fill them with water, and then you can't tell, right?
I figured that out the second time.
Ed hops on stream for 3 hours and then can't sleep for a week.
Yeah. After you've escaped samsara by drinking 25 Red Bulls.
Uh-huh. Actually, this brings me to easily the most horrifying thing I've ever seen on TikTok, which happened this past weekend. Are y'all familiar with the concept of an infused Red Bull?
I am not.
No.
I'm going to plead the fifth.
So this is a thing they're doing out west, apparently. I think it's a California thing. I don't know. I saw a TikTok where these two women were like, we moved to Florida and they don't do infused Red Bulls out here, so we have to go get a Monster. I'm like, why is this in my FYP? Whatever. What's an infused Red Bull? An infused Red Bull is some sort of flavoring syrup. And the video I saw had a woman pouring about 3 or 4 ounces of Monin coffee syrup, blue raspberry flavor, into a plastic cup, adding pebble ice. Okay, so far this is could be worse. She then goes in with a sugar-free Red Bull. Has to be sugar-free, apparently. Why? I don't know. And this is bad so far, right? You've got a huge slug of pure sugar, blue raspberry syrup, and Red Bull. That's grim. She finished this thing off with 3 ounces of heavy cream.
Ooh. All right. I hadn't heard that one. That's worse.
I mean, that's got a curdle, right?
Apparently, there's a way you can... I watched her make it, and it did not look curdled. It looked... It didn't look curdled to me. It looked absolutely horrifying, but not because it was curdled.
I mean, like, you've just found a way for me to be able to judge someone, and I'm someone who drinks 2 Monsters a day.
Oh, buddy, you are in such a lighter place than this person.
I know. I'm over here like, wow, I feel good about my choices.
I don't know. I like heavy cream, though. I think we should use heavy cream more. Lipids are great.
I'm not against that. I'm not against a pro-lipids agenda, but no.
I would just like to have the lipids separate from the Red Bull, please. Heavy cream, fine. In some cases, I'm very much in favor. Red Bull, there's a time and a place. Together, never.
I'm going to be honest. I thought that story was going to end with vodka, and I would have been like, well, I mean, like, I'm not 22 anymore, but, like, I get it. But,
sir,
like,
come on.
Heavy
I don't cream? Think I don't think vodka mistakes are not a 22-year-old thing. Those are like a 17-year-old thing.
Nope.
Disagree.
Because when you have lots of free Red Bull, you have to find something to do with it.
This Red Bull thing is also why Ed can drink Diet Pepsi out of a coffee cup at 9 o'clock at night.
And no, that's just my raging ADHD. But I'm sure that didn't help.
That's true, actually. That the people with ADHD often have a paradoxical caffeine effect.
Friend of the podcast, former guest from before my time, Fane Greenwood, and I have compared notes, and it's like, yes, this is what that's like. And I was like, cool, somebody understands.
And that's like a general stimulant thing too, right? Because I have tried Adderall off label previously, and
is that what you call it?
Yeah, that's not helping me focus. That is not the effect that's having on me.
Yeah, it kind of speeds up certain things, so your gears are sort of synced up. Is the idea? At least that's how it was explained.
The real problem with Adderall is that I start focusing on the wrong things.
Really?
That's like, I'm supposed to go, like, be a productive member of society. Nope, I just organized that bookshelf for 4 hours.
See, I also have ADHD, and that's kind of me in the steady state, is that I have a lot of attention. Shortage of attention is not the problem here.
It just goes to fun places.
Yeah, I can't direct it very efficiently, so...
This is genuinely one of the reasons why I run the risk of seeming like an AI hype guy on Blue Sky, because the robot does my programming for me. And yeah, I have to go fix parts of it later, but it actually gets done. And that's a really novel feeling for me. It's like, cool, the robot, sure, I have to review it, but the thing got done and I didn't just go take 2 walks because I was bored. So, like, you know, swings and roundabouts.
I feel like Red Bull is British coded.
Definitely European.
Isn't it German?
Yeah, I mean, they're headquartered in Austria.
Austria, that's right.
Yeah.
I bet those guys who were painting the St. George's flag over that convenience store, I bet those guys are really big on Red Bull.
What's more British-coded? Actually, really English-coded. What's more English-coded? A Red Bull or vaping in a shed?
Oh, vaping. Ooh. 10 times.
I need calling to look it a shed. In a shed.
Calling it a shed, I think, is pretty English coded.
Yeah, that's true.
Or I was going to say New England, but you know, point stands.
England, New England. I mean, it's all really the same.
British energy drinks. Looking them up. I'm trying to see if they have any. I'm trying to see if they have any homegrown.
Do they put like blackcurrant in there?
They do, actually. I know they do because they sponsored an F. The guy that had a British energy drink company sponsored an F1 team, and it was an absolute disaster.
Glucozade, started as Glucozade in 1927, which gives me some real patent medicine vibes.
I've had that. It's okay.
Rebranded as a sports drink at some point, which I'm sure, you know, sure, it cures what ails you, and I don't know.
Got Roger Bannister through the 4-minute mile.
All of our athletes are drinking Gatorade and, you know, doing proper nutrition and strength and conditioning, and the Brits are over here drinking rocket fuel before they're theatrical grass diving.
So that's where all the East German coaches went.
It does weird me out how Celsius energy drinks are positioning themselves as a sort of a sports drink, because the last time I had a Celsius, I had it at about 10 a.m., and I had a really hard time getting to sleep that night.
God, what's that like?
Not well, that specific situation wasn't great. I mean,
I can drink a Monster and go to bed.
That's wild. I don't.
It just does nothing. My hands don't even, like, my hands don't shake. Okay, it's just like it just goes in one ear, out the other, or pick an orifice.
If I have a second coffee after about 2 p.m., there is no chance I'm getting 7 hours of sleep.
Oh, I get a solid 8. Yeah,
with a Red Bull or a Monster on your side table in your bedstand.
Who drinks that warm? Oh, it's in the mini fridge. I made that one up, as far as you know.
There's been this great inflation of the amount of caffeine that's in things.
It is, and honestly, like the reason I do drink Monsters because the other ones are too high test. Really? I have standards.
Monster is the low caffeine option.
Monsters, I forget what it is, but some of them are like 200 milligrams a can. Some are like 300. I think Monster's like 160.
Oof.
That's a sizable amount, but you get up to 300 and I'm like, damn, even I can feel my blood pressure now.
160 is like 2 cups of coffee. That's not killing anybody.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Because I have no idea how much that is.
I think like a delicious can of a 12-ounce can of Diet Pepsi, I think, is like 40.
Yep.
So it's not. Right. It's a normal person will probably still vibrate through the wall
from the Monster, not the Diet Pepsi. To be clear,
I mean, if you've drunk 4 of them.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
that's the kind of volume we're working with here. I didn't realize we were that high up the.
I know you're a high test economist guy, but 160 divided by 40 is 4.
I thought you were talking about a single can of Diet Pepsi.
No, God, no.
So I may be generation gapping myself here, but do you guys remember Jolt Cola?
I do.
But I remember it from the attempted relaunch.
Right. They brought it back, but the original Jolt Cola, which was marketed as a super high caffeine, get you going, the energy drink of its time, which was, you know, 80s, 90s, had a whopping 71 milligrams of caffeine. And that was the high test stuff.
I mean,
and we're regularly 4-timesing that now with a small format can.
Oh yeah. And like, great. Like some of those kill people, or if they don't, they will. But, some of them are also just like really weird, like post-workout drinks. And unfortunately the best tasting energy drink out there, like loads up with, I forget what it is, but it makes your face tingle. And that's not good.
I've never gone into the whole caffeine for workout thing, man. Like I exercise minimum 5 days a week. I got off the treadmill. I'm like, why did I just do that to myself? I'm like that kind of exercise guy. Right. And the idea of supplementing that with a stimulant, just, I don't understand why someone would do that to themselves. Now, like a marathon runner may be different because you're at such a lower heart rate and it's such a sustained activity that, okay, whatever.
I mean, that's just any port in a storm.
Yeah. Right?
Like you find what works and you go with it.
Yeah, totally. That's not, very few people are exercising that way. And I think for most people, you're talking about much higher increase in intensity over whatever your baseline activity level is, and why you would compound that jolt with caffeine. I don't get it. I do not understand the logic.
I didn't care much for Jolt, but I do want them to bring back Surge if we're wishing on 90 strings.
They did bring back Surge once too, and I will be honest, I was not impressed.
Hmm. I never had it when they brought it back.
The wizards behind Flavorology have done a lot of work over the last 30 years. Things just taste better now.
The Mountain Dew Research Division alone has revolutionized the game.
when we do a live event for charity at some point, now I'm obligating you all to it, I actually have a small vial of concentrated Baja Blast flavor.
Oh my god.
And we can find a use for it for charity.
Shots.
I will point out there's no sugar in it, so it's the weirdest thing in the world.
I can't imagine what Baja Blast would taste like without any sugar. I cannot.
It's terrible. I'm trying to... The one way we found to make it tolerable was rum, oddly enough.
Hmm.
Well, rum is very sweet.
Yeah.
As hard liquor goes.
Yeah, and like all of those fake fruit flavors, you know, you kind of hide them. I'm not saying it was good, but you know, you could get away with it.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to convince me that was good, buddy.
Would I lie to you?
For a bit. Yeah. To get me to drink whatever you're trying to convince me to on stream. Yeah, for sure.
Mailing out shots to everybody.
So I think the caffeine story is a good reminder of the real warning sign for where we're at with Democrats these days. I learned about, I'm going to get there. Propter is leaning back in his chair with his hands behind his head because I think he knows where I'm going with this. When I was in college, there was a really good trade done by a couple fraternities using a dorm room to store bulk Four Loko that had the caffeine in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they were able to do this, the reason they were able to sell it forward and make a pretty healthy profit is because Chuck Schumer got involved advocating for a ban on Four Loko, which at the time was obviously very high in caffeine and alcohol combined, which has some of the same problems I was describing with workouts and caffeine, but you know, in a slightly different format. So the high test Four Loko made it years past the market date if you knew the right people to go to. So that experience of Chuck Schumer banning my college campus's favorite pregame drink was my first introduction to him and his specific politics.
So the nice thing was they banned Four Loko just before I graduated college.
Beautiful.
And by the nice thing is, I mean, I'm surprised we didn't die. Like that stuff was everywhere. And did you know they relaunched it twice now? The first relaunch was no alcohol. The new relaunch is, as near as I can tell, basically a 40 with fruit flavoring.
That stuff tasted like death. There is just no other way to describe Four Loko other than death.
You are not wrong.
It's so bad.
I am starting, as you say that it was your favorite pregame drink at Duke, I am starting to understand Duke's lack of football prowess for
most
of its history.
Hey, the Fighting Manny Diaz's are going to show you what's what this year, buddy.
I don't think we play
the
you guys.
24-ounce can at 14 ABV. See, I'm trying desperately to not talk about Duke, so we're looking at the Four Loko brand experience now.
I'm actually a little surprised that there hasn't been a push to bring Four Loko back in its original formulation under the Trump administration. That feels very on brand for them.
Give it a minute.
Don't give them ideas. Oh, they're going to do it.
The watermelon flavor and everything.
They're going to add beef tallow to it.
Speaking of lipids.
Not all lipids caffeine. Are good, guys. have a special guest with us tonight. Musicology Duck from Blue Sky is here. Musicology Duck is a DC resident who has been out in the streets doing what I think could be fairly described as citizen journalism for the past couple of weeks during the DC occupation. And we thought that it would be a good idea to get some other perspectives on to talk about what's happening in DC, since it's come to my attention that I'm perhaps a little more optimistic than many of my fellow city residents. With no further ado, here is Musicology Duck.
Hi, good evening.
So what's going on? You've been out there following feds around, taking pictures and kind of keeping track of what's happening. What do you see?
I have. You know, I'm the daughter of like a police family on one side and journalists on the other. So,
and that's quite a mix.
Former distance runner. So I think it's already been my habit to kind of wander the streets of our nation's capital for hours and miles at a time. So I haven't really been doing anything out of the ordinary. It's what I've been seeing.
What kind of splits are you getting on these wanderings? Are you like some
it
eight?
Depends on if something strange happens halfway through. Like, does the entire National Guard just suddenly walk out of the USDA building? It's a little different every night, I feel like. When I first started, you know, seeing what other people were posting, it's like, oh, well, there's randomly DEA agents walking around the mall. How hilarious is that? And I went and took my normal evening walk. Sure enough, there's these roving bands of a whole mix of agencies. And it's been interesting to kind of watch it change and develop over the last couple of weeks. And there have been a few of us just out there with our cell phones because the media can't cover it all. The media is not necessarily interested in covering it all. It's a mix of both first draft of history and trying to warn our neighbors.
One thing that's really struck me is that so many of what we're seeing in terms of documentation of this is coming from people like you who are citizens out there in the streets. It's not coming from major news organizations. It's just coming directly from people with cell phones. And I guess that's kind of a feature of the way media works now, of the way kind of the record is constructed. It feels a little different when it's in the city you live in, at least to me. The usual record of things it's coming to us less mediated than it might otherwise be. We're getting bits and pieces of ground truth that aren't necessarily being woven together into anything that's intended to be a narrative in real time. And one of the things that I've really struggled with is trying to figure out whether or not this is real, whether or not this is a major crackdown and we are now under military rule in the District of Columbia, and this is something that is a big problem, or whether this is something where basically if we dodge and we ignore it for a couple of weeks, it'll probably go away. What's your feeling at this point?
I feel like it's just a shifting situation, and a lot of people want to be able to take the data we have so far. Like, I saw that Washington Post map that was circulating for a little while. Like, this is where we have confirmed sightings, or people wanting to say, well, we've seen them around the monuments, or we've seen them in Georgetown. So that's what this means. But it hasn't stayed consistent this whole time. There's not been night to night that's the same. They've spread out. Like, the National Guard has more taken over the monuments duty, whereas the agencies that are kind of grabbing people off the streets are more sporadic in different neighborhoods, different checkpoints, you know, sometimes at the same location, sometimes not. So I don't personally find it incredibly easy to predict, you know, far out. I do feel like something kind of turned this weekend. It was very strange being down at the wharf. It's not the same. You know, up till now, I'd sort of seen maybe two or three guardsmen in a unit walking around or patrolling, but suddenly seeing these big groups of them. I don't know if it's just because there's more in town now. I've started seeing them be rude or mean to people instead of just kind of ignoring whoever they run into in the course of their...
You posted something about seeing guardsmen spitting on a woman.
Yeah, like last night I was coming back from the Trader Joe's at Noma, got on the metro, and I was coming up the escalator as this other woman was coming down the stairs, and I heard her like having an exchange with someone who was still up on the platform. And, you know, she was saying, well, I thought this was supposed to be a nice city now. And they were just kind of sarcastically yelling back at her and sort of spitting or fake spitting. And I got up to the top and saw that it was two National Guardsmen who had been, you know, taunting a DC resident. And
That's ugly.
I pulled out my camera to start to film, and they just sort of started sarcastically waving back at me and being obnoxious. It's just, you know, that felt a little different than what I'd seen out on the mall or at Union Station, where they're clearly bored out of their minds and just standing around, but not really interacting with the residents unless people come by and ask for selfies. You see stuff like that. But I don't know if it's just that there's more of them here now, but it has felt different in the last couple of days. I'm seeing them in parts of town I wasn't. I was just walking around Capitol Hill today. I haven't seen any in Capitol Hill, but they were like in front, between the Capitol and the Library of Congress, which is usually Capitol Police territory. It's just, it's hard to draw conclusions. People might be overreading into certain things. Like, are they just in places that Pam Bondi has heard of? Are they just making it up as they go along? Are they learning from what happened night to night?
I was kind of excited when the map said that they were around the Nats Park, because I'm all in favor of rounding up Nats fans.
The Nats could maybe use some hitting this year. I'm probably here reflected in this conversation that the district to me feels split between bravado and anguish. There's a real strain that wants to say, you know, screw you, get out of our city, you can't touch us, you won't break us. And there's another strain that's really worried. And I think that parts of that have come through in your posting and in your photography, that there's real concern here for people in DC, especially for anybody who ICE is pursuing right now, but really for anybody who might get crossways with the occupiers. Where are you right now on bravado v. anguish?
I've sort of said, and I still think this is true, that they have two fronts that they're fighting on. One is the propaganda. Like, they want to be photographed by the monuments. They want to have this show of power that's seen in the media and seen as intimidating. And then there's the parts I'm not so sure how much of it they want us to see, but is covering up ICE raids is, you know, has been some really violent arrests. I was out on one of the nights that they were targeting homeless encampments, and it was not only incredibly disturbing to witness, but you could see them becoming uncomfortable when neighbors were starting to film. That they were targeting people outside of a church, and you could tell they were trying to hang to the side where they weren't on the church property or where the church wasn't going to be seen, because there were media there too. It wasn't just, you know, me with my phone. So you can see them thinking about how's this going to look on multiple fronts. They don't need five of those giant military vehicles outside Union Station. Like, that, I feel like, was for photographs. Like, are they going to take out the Capitol? Like, what's that for? That's for pictures.
I saw one of them T-boned a car the other day, a little Ford crossover over in, I think, nearabouts where you are, Propter. Yeah. I was pretty impressed by the little Ford. It held up pretty well. Crumple zones, baby.
That's right, baby. Blue oval.
I guess a National Guardsman in an MRAP blew a red light, and we were very lucky that there weren't serious injuries.
Well, I had seen them out there a night or two before, and they had what looked like an MPD escort, and they were caravanning, but they didn't have anybody actually stopping traffic for it. So they were just ignoring the lights and going in their little line. So I kind of wasn't surprised that Columbus Circle can already be a little bit confusing, especially if you've never driven through it before. So
I was actually in DC last fall for the first time in, I don't know, 3 or 4 years at least. And I drove my truck into the city and like into DC proper, because I didn't really think this through. What I should have done is parked outside and take the metro in, which is what I would have done in New York, because I know New York well enough that, you know, whatever. And I got to say, if you haven't been in DC proper recently and you're planning to drive a car there, just don't do it. It's not worth it. And this is not a criticism of DC at all. This is actually a huge compliment. It's because they have really pedestrianized so much of DC so effectively. There are bike lanes everywhere. There's lots of pedestrian infrastructure that makes it much safer for people who aren't on the road. There is a pretty high volume of traffic. It's not necessarily like Midtown was back when I lived in New York, but I mean, it's pretty high volume of traffic, and it's just a pain to get around. It's slow, and you can bike, scooter, take the metro, walk, and it's going to be faster and much more pleasant. So huge ups to DC for doing that. Next time I will not be driving in to DC proper with my F-150 Lightning, and I will be much happier for it. So big, big win, I think, there for the residents of DC.
Yeah, we've still got the maze of one-way streets and exits where if you go one way, you'll you'll be going that way for a while. We talked about a couple of places here. We mentioned Union Station. We mentioned the Wharf. The Wharf, for people who don't know DC, is sort of a, it is not the rough and tumble area that the name might suggest. It's kind of a constructed adult playground that went in where the Wharf used to be. There are still some wharf activities down there, but it's basically a nightlife district right now with some condos and apartments. Lots of bars, lots of restaurants.
Now, this is the Wharf. This is not the thing down by the Wilson Bridge, the National...
National Harbor?
National Harbor.
No. Different than National Harbor. Closer.
I don't think I've ever actually been to the Wharf.
Yeah, I mean, it basically didn't exist. I mean, it's probably been maybe a decade since they started building it up. It happened really fast. It used to be, you know, an actual wharf, and now it's... I mean, it's a fun place to go spend an evening, but again, it's in line with very touristy places where, for instance, members of the administration are reasonably likely to live or to go.
It's also been one of the spots where they've been targeting youth with the youth curfews, because kids have been going down there and hanging out in large numbers, because there's, you know, not a ton of places for them to go after 8 p.m. or so, and there were already some heavy policing issues down that way that I think they've taken advantage of the situation to greatly increase.
To the point of like anger versus anguish, I think a big issue is that we're not really sure what the end game is here, right? Like what is it y'all are trying to do? You've arrested a couple, ICE has arrested a couple guys from what I've seen, but a lot of this is guys just standing around. You know, the guys on the mall are probably miserable too because they're wearing, you know, those heavy uniforms. And DC this time of year is not the most pleasant place to be in the world.
You know, just our luck, we've actually had really nice weather for the past 2 weeks. So our natural defenses are failing us right now.
But, and they're mindful of things like the church and in the scene that Duck was talking about earlier. So it doesn't sound like this is some sort of like military coup and Trump becomes dictator for life thing or something like that. This, it seems to me that it's probably more on the side of the propaganda than the side of like cease for now.
I mean, I think the ICE dragnets are very real.
Yes.
And you know, that's something that's happening in a lot of places and is maybe more accentuated here in part because there's greater agent density. There's just a lot of boots on the ground right now in DC.
Right.
Military part hasn't been as scary. It's weird. It's strange to look at. There's a lot of them. I don't like that they have guns now. I think there's a high likelihood something happens accidentally, especially if we have folks who are not familiar with DC and don't know how easy it might be to turn down a residential street or to end up in Maryland or there's any number of things that could happen, but the big groups of federal agents are pretty scary. Their behavior is pretty scary, and they're really roughing some people up. And they're unpredictable. They'll get mad at people for filming. They're bloodying people for things like fare evasion, which is usually a civic violation with a $50 fine. That scares me more than seeing the soldiers around town.
In terms of behavior, is there any difference that you've been able to tell between the different agencies, National Guard units, how any way you can distinguish, like, are they all behaving the same way? Are they behaving wildly different? Are there consistent patterns for given agencies and how they behave? And yeah, I mean, what's the story there?
I don't think I've seen enough of anyone. Like, it seems like DEA and Park Police are maybe the most numerous. The ICE agents and some of the others don't really wear agency identification, or it's hard to tell who they are. Like, I have some photos of just a masked man standing in the middle of Hugh Street. No idea who he is, who he's with, what he's doing, but they were just annoying some men who had apparently been filming a podcast on Hugh Street and interviewing passersby, and I'm not sure what precipitated it, but suddenly maybe 12 different officers that I couldn't identify where they were all from. Who knows what vest they're wearing? Are they really wearing the vest from the agency that they're from? Like, it's, you see them driving cars that don't totally make sense. Like, it's really hard to tell who's who, what's what sometimes, and the behavior is quite scary.
One thing that stands out is the size of the groups that are going around, correct? I mean, these are not, you know, these are not partnered pairs typically moving. Mm-hmm. This is like five or six dudes at once.
Or more, depending on what they seem to be up to. Like the first night that I started seeing them, it was mostly groups of four, but you'll see easily 10 or 12.
Have you seen anybody carrying rifles at this point?
I mean, the agency guys have, yeah, I've seen Secret Service with rifles for days, different kinds of weapons. I have not seen the National Guard with rifles. I saw some this morning that looks like they had the little pistols, maybe. It's kind of hard to tell. But
honestly, given some of the gun safety issues with their handguns, the presence of a rifle might be more comforting than a gun that might go off without being intended to be fired.
Yeah, background on that is that prior to, I think it was yesterday, the National Guard was not carrying weapons in D.C. It's clear there's a push with the administration to get them to carry weapons, and it sounds like at least some of the Guard units are a little reluctant to do that. So they are now mostly not all carrying pistols, but not rifles. But the announcement was that some of them would be carrying rifles. So we'll see if that's actually happening.
It does seem like, you know, there was one night I was down on the mall and there was almost no National Guard, and it was really strange after several nights of a lot of them. And then it turned out they were all being sworn in by the U.S. Marshal's Office and getting some weapons training. So it does seem like there's some kind of training or some kind of learnings going on. It's one of those things where I don't know if it'll stay the same.
Some sort of crash course in using a handgun.
The other question I would have too about the patterns you've seen, if you could hazard a guess based on your walks and what you've seen, at any given time, what percentage of DC proper has a National Guard or federal agency or whatever unit within a couple blocks? I mean, I know this is kind of like hazy. I'm just curious for your impression. Are we talking about every other block you're seeing somebody, or you're going half a mile in between sightings or longer, or does it vary so much that you can't even hazard a guess?
When it very first started, when the Guard very first got here, they were almost nowhere but by the Washington Monument. Like, I would go down and walk almost the whole mall and the basin area, and I think I described it on social media as if it was like they had a hive inside the Washington Monument and weren't going much farther than that. But then, you know, a couple days later, I forget which metro station I was at. I think it was Chinatown metro station. And there were a couple of uniformed guard walking up and down the platform. And I had never seen them outside the sort of national parks area. And I was really surprised. It's like, are they going somewhere and they just still have their uniforms on, or are they patrolling the platform? And then the next morning, it was announced that they're patrolling, I think, 10 different metro stations in the subway system.
They heard how cheap the Chinatown bus was.
But after that, you started to see them much more spread out. So they're based out of these different metro stations, and you're also seeing them on foot within several blocks. And most of those metro stations are the ones in the central part of DC. It's not the ones all the way out, you know, by the border with Maryland or whatever. It's around the mall. It's sort of the main stations in the core of the city. So if you're around those parts of town, it sometimes does feel like every block or every corner you turn, there's at least several National Guard patrolling, or every metro station you go on, you know, stop at, get running errands, there's somewhere between 3 and 10 guardsmen at the station. I think the agency alphabet soup has been a little less predictable. The first few nights, it felt like they were truly everywhere on the mall and around the White House, especially. Just going down 15th Street, stuff down there, you'd see several wandering bands of agency. I feel like I haven't seen them as numerous, but it's hard to tell. And it feels like they might be doing more targeted raids of certain areas. And if you go down U Street on a Friday night or something, you'll probably see quite a few.
How are you holding up with all this? I mean, it can't be easy.
It's definitely strange. I feel like I don't know yet. It's also, I was very active as a legal observer in 2020. It's not my first time seeing a protest or seeing tanks on the street every day. But DC is so compact that compared to other cities that I've lived in, we're just trying to go about errands in the course of the day when you're in not that many square miles.
We've got to issue a correction. Last week on the podcast, we said DC was about 40 square miles. It is about 68 square miles. That's my mistake.
But still not large. So it does feel sometimes like, man, I can't even go to the grocery store without potentially seeing something traumatizing. That's hard. And you see your friends on social media posting someone getting completely taken down by agents for fare evasion, or you know, someone that got arrested just for filming. We'll see what that's doing to my brain day after day, but I really hope that it stays with the 30-day period.
One thing I'm not hearing much of at all is fighting crime, which, if memory serves, was the entire premise for this ridiculous charade. I mean, I suppose you could call fare evasion crime, but that ranks pretty low on my list, somewhere, you know, maybe above jaywalking, not much, though. But it doesn't sound like anything to deal with whatever crime problem that our big wet president has imagined in his head. Nothing going on that.
Yeah, I was a little bit amused. The other day I walked past Union Station when it was still one of the main places where one of the only places that the National Guard was camped out. And I saw them basically giving show and tells of the military vehicles that were out there to kids because they had nothing else to do. There was like a couple protesters maybe, but it was just like all of that area was deserted. And I kept going and went and got dinner at a restaurant a couple blocks away. And while I was in there, I got like DC's alert system has a crime alert and you can sign up for places that you frequent and they'll tell you if there's a crime alert nearby. And I got one for the block of Union Station. There had been a robbery like on the one block that the National Guard could see from the five different military vehicles they had.
So that the deterrence is clearly working wonders.
Like, you do have to wonder, but then again, there's not a lot of tourists here right now. It's, you know, August can be quiet with Congress gone, but it feels weird. And a lot of my friends who work in bars and restaurants have been saying their income's going down and they're worried about it. You worry about that a little bit. Like, part of what gives you a sense of safety in a place like this is knowing that your neighbors are out and about and will see things. That's one of the protective defenses the city of DC kind of brought about organically, is when these raids happen, neighbors are immediately out there with cameras or they're out there with signs saying turn now because ICE is on the next block. And if people aren't outside, I don't like that.
Yeah. Is it your sense that people are staying inside more, or are things still
like, I feel like I might have a better sense when Congress gets back. Like it's a little bit of a dead time, but there's been an international tourist shaped hole in the economy for a little while, I think is safe to say, other than maybe 4th of July, a little bit when Trump had his military parade. You haven't seen as many families just wandering around, checking out the sites. Like the streets around the Capitol building have been super quiet. A lot of the restaurants that you usually feel lucky to get a seat, plenty open.
Generally not a good sign for an economy, and especially with DC right now, because, you know, I'd imagine international tourism is way down, just given that we've sought to piss off every country we conceivably can. Then you've had all of these folks laid off by DOGE as well, which is probably having a pretty sizable impact.
Yeah, people are moving away. And like the strange thing all summer has been how the food trucks on the mall and the vendors have disappeared, but there's very few. Usually that's big business, prime territory. There's usually some news story about them getting a family from out of town to pay $22 for an ice cream cone. It's completely quiet down there, which is just so strange. And you don't know if it's because there's no one to sell to, or are the proprietors getting scared by ICE or swept up by ICE.
There is pretty good data to support the idea that the labor market in the DMV is very, very challenged right now. So since the election, the number of people who are receiving jobless benefits has doubled. And the claims for government workers, if you that's a national statistic, but it's obviously concentrated around DC. They're up 82% year over year through the latest week of data. If you look at the performance of DC, Maryland, and Virginia combined, pretty big increase year over year compared to everybody else in the rest of the country. So there's good evidence that those labor markets are struggling right now.
We're also about to hit the end of the payout period for all the feds who took Elon's fork in the road and took a buyout and voluntary retirement. That will mean less money in the area. Also, those guys are all going to show up on the, the November jobs report, the October jobs report they're going to hit.
Depends on the specific timing. I think it'll probably be in a couple of different months, but October is what I recall being the one that would be the big hit, but I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Do we still have a jobs report?
I mean, we will for the near term. So, you know, we've talked about this on previous episodes, but the BLS commissioner that Trump says he's going to appoint has to get cleared through the Senate. That obviously takes time, assuming it happens at all, which I don't know. I don't want to lay odds on that, but I could see it. I could see him failing in the Senate. I could also see him getting through. I don't know. So then he has to be in, you know, get into the actual agency and start doing his thing. And it's not clear how long it would take for him to start monkeying around, assuming he actually does, which maybe he won't. I don't know. But certainly in the next couple months, there's no change in the jobs data. It's the same civil servants doing the same thing they've done. After that, once, I can't remember Numbnuts' name. What's his name?
EJ again? Anthony.
Yeah, that guy. Yeah, I'm going to have an anti-Italian discrimination moment here. But
he's got kind of a weird Nazi ship fixation thing. He's a big fan of the Bismarck.
Yeah, with the weirdest ship to be a fan of if you're like an actual...
Yeah, that was... Didn't that ship get like... completely rinsed by like five Brits in a rowboat or something.
It was biplanes that flew under the angle the anti-aircraft guns on that ship could shoot at. I mean, like literal biplanes, which were not the planes that World War II was primarily fought with. So a little retro tech.
I mean, if that isn't a perfect metaphor for the fascist aesthetic of violence, I don't know what is, right? Like it's entirely about show, it's entirely about attention, it's got nothing to do with actually doing something you're trying to do. It's just entirely the image, which I think, you know, given like we've said before, that is a huge part of what's going on in DC, and I think Duck was right to point out that a lot of this is trying to generate attention. It's such a transparently obvious propaganda project at the same time.
I wish we were tracking it in more detail, because I feel like we could start to distinguish between what's what. But yeah, the Washington Post style map of a little pinpoint where you don't know what happened, when, what time, was it sustained over several days or weeks, was it just some guys taking a walk in Georgetown? Like, it doesn't feel like anybody's doing the work of pulling all of that information together.
You know, once in a while we've gotten stats from the administration themselves. They said that we're a little over 1,000 arrests total. It's been going on for, I think, 11 days now. The conversion rate on arrests into successful convictions looks like it's not going to be very good. We've already gotten several grand juries turning down indictments. Which is rare. That is, as a prosecutor, that's a failure condition if you can't get the grand jury to indict the person you want to indict.
Yeah, grand jury is playing on a mode that is so easy that anything beyond that is nightmare mode. If you can't get it through a grand jury, you ain't going to get a conviction.
But the flip side of that is that the reason grand jury is easy mode is that there's a great deal of credibility that the state has in under typical circumstances that may be eroded here. That if you don't presume that the prosecutor is telling you the truth, if you don't presume that they're acting in good faith, then you're going to start not doing what they want you to do. And it may be that we're already at that point in DC where, you know, Even stuff that they're not ridiculously overcharging, which they are with almost everything they can get their hands on right now, they're throwing felonies around for things that are manifestly not felonies. But even if they were charging appropriately for the crimes, at some point, a citizen jury pool is just going to tell them to screw off. It's too early at this point, I think, to say whether or not we've crossed that threshold in DC. But one of the reasons why you don't do things like systematically overcharge and you don't do things like bring ticky-tack charges in front of a grand jury is because you blow out your credibility.
And it's gotten so bad that there was one case, this woman named Sidney Laurie Reed, brought in front of a grand jury twice, and both times they returned no bill. And so she's now being charged with a misdemeanor. Oh, three times. I'm sorry. I was out of date by a week.
Got the hat trick.
Three. That is unbelievable. Like, I can't. Has that ever happened before? Proctor, have you ever heard of someone going in front of a grand jury three times? And
I'm sure it's happened. I've never heard of it. Whoever was driving that is going to get some crap from the people at the office. That's a poor performance.
I mean, I've heard of lawyers having bad days, but you know, every lawyer has that one trial where they have to defend something in front of the judge that's just complete garbage and just get beat to hell. But this is next level.
I mean, Jeanine Pirro was the one that signed the downgrade to a misdemeanor today. So presumably that's who's calling the shots on this and completely blowing it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Jeanine Pirro's not a real lawyer.
Yeah.
Is part of the problem here.
Yeah.
You know, she's got some very old experience in doing not really what she's doing right now. She doesn't necessarily know why the guardrails are there in terms of don't overcharge people. And I think she's finding that out in real time. Also, the DC prosecutor's office is understaffed, in part because they fired a whole bunch of people and in part because a bunch of people.
I mean, we've been saying it for months now, like they're going to run out of lawyers. They're going to run out of lawyers. And especially when you're talking about a place where the jury pool is going to be as sympathetic towards the defendant as you could possibly imagine. Like, you cannot come up with a more sympathetic jury pool than the people that are going to be dragged down to sit on juries in front of these charges. I mean, let alone the actual trial itself.
Not to mention you made them come down for grand jury duty, walking through a bunch of guardsmen and DEA agents and ICE agents who have spent the last however many days, what is it, 11 days now, pissing you off. So you're probably not a big fan of Jeanine Pirro right now and anything that Jeanine Pirro is trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
I mean, my guess is at this point, you've got probably 30% of DC that would walk into a jury pool and tell the judge that they've never even heard of a sandwich. You know, that they just people are really, really angry right now here in the district.
What's that's something, I don't know if you can speak to this, Proctor, or if Duck, you can speak to this, but what is the vibe in like Southeast? Because DC is kind of two different cities, right? There is a pretty big socioeconomic divide in DC between, I mean, I spent a summer in DC as an intern and I stayed on campus at Georgetown. And that is a very different vibe from the less socioeconomically advanced parts of the city. So do we have a feel for what folks down there are experiencing through this in areas that are the opposite of high tourist traffic typically and the opposite of high visibility, and also how they feel about the whole thing?
Even I've walked farther out, it hasn't been the sort of sustained attention that other parts of the city have been getting. It's felt more random when I've seen or heard things happening, but people are angry, people are scared. I don't even know that that's limited to a specific part of the city. Even in the wealthier areas, Free DC has people out at 8 p.m. banging pots and pans and making noise and, you know, flying the DC flag. And you see a lot of that even in the wealthier areas. I think the divides are more along the lines of who actually lives in DC full time, who has to take the metro and walk and see all of this every day versus getting in a hired car and kind of going around it. Like, I think there are different lifestyle things even that, because I go out walking for 4 to 8 miles a day, but there are places you can avoid it and places you can't. But the anger seems to be about like how you feel about DC as an independently governed place, I think.
We have some polling on this that people in DC do not like the occupation at all. It's getting maybe not quite Assad numbers, but pretty close to Assad numbers against. I think we were at something like 85% in opposition on the last polling I saw. So insofar as there's that, that's what Southeast thinks. They're part of that number.
Some pretty big protests too, like the one that went from DuPont Circle to the White House. I guess that was last weekend. It was pretty large, 2-3 city blocks long by the time it reached full. You know, everybody had kind of snowballed onto it. People are angry.
Is the occupation filtering into Southeast all that much? Like, do we have guardsmen walking around Congress Heights and Anacostia and areas like that to the same extent that we have them in, Northwest and around the mall?
Last time I walked down towards Anacostia, I didn't see much, but I do know that they're using the Park Police headquarters down there as kind of a home base. That's where Trump had his pizza party the other night. There is some activity down there, maybe a slightly different sort. But I keep saying we need to put a big old yet on everything. Just because they're not doing it today doesn't mean it's not coming, or that it's not in the plan, or they just discovered that part of DC exists. Like, I don't know. I don't always feel comfortable reading into it based on what's been there in the last 2 weeks.
It really makes you question, at least it really makes me question my own judgment a lot. That, you know, am I right that this is not that bad? Maybe this is way worse than I think. Or maybe it's not as bad as I think it is so far. Because the presence is variable. It's not consistent. These guys are not all out on the street at the same time. They're not on every street that they're on.
And I think it depends on what you see that night that I saw them targeting houseless folks and throwing, you know, probably an 80-year-old man up against a brick wall. That when you see that, it's impossible not to be horrified and angry and just want them out as soon as possible. Where if your experience is more, oh, I just saw a couple National Guard on the way to work. Like, maybe you see some of it on social media, but I don't know if it hits in the same, like, visceral way as just watching something go down right in front of your eyes that's cruel and doesn't need to happen and doesn't solve crime, doesn't solve homelessness.
It's happening very violently also. That one thing that shows up in a lot of the things that we've seen on camera is that there is not a lot of respect being given to people's persons in this.
And even when it's not downright violent, it's still menacing. Like, sometimes they'll start filming you back. They'll get in the faces of just onlookers and people that are trying to help or just trying to find out who's being arrested so they can let their families know. And just encountering that kind of cruelty so many places so directly, like, that has changed me, and that has felt very different than even 2020 when there was tanks in the street preventing the protest and monitoring the Black Lives Matter, because it's so much more personal and in our neighborhoods, and in, you know, if you don't have a house to live in the place where you sleep. These men are showing up covering their faces because they're too embarrassed to let the world know who they really are when they're doing this work. I don't know. Once you see that happen, especially in person, it's pretty hard to think that this is going to just go away without someone intervening. And I do wonder what will happen when legislators get back to town and start seeing how pervasive this is, or if they encounter it, or if something happens to a staffer. I don't know, but it's almost hard. Like, the videos almost don't do it justice. It's just when you see them interacting with people on the street.
Is there any sense that Bowser and her administration could be doing more to resist this or doing more to protect residents? Or is there sort of a understanding that there's only so much she can do given DC's rather unique legal status? I mean, she can't make the kind of statement or make the kind of promise around self-sovereignty that, for instance, Governor Pritzker made today in Illinois, right? Or could she? I mean, what's the story there?
I don't know. Like, I just feel like I personally don't feel like I've heard much about what she's doing or saying. I do believe there's some real limitations there, but, you know, the big story when she went to a family event on Martha's Vineyard right when this was all happening. Like, people notice that and they feel like they're local leaders or maybe not even paying lip service to standing up for us on a regular basis.
And Eleanor Holmes Norton has been entirely MIA. I mean, she's 88 years old and there are questions about her health, but I don't think she's appeared in public since this started. She's DC's non-voting representative to the House of Representatives.
It's like just even knowing Congress out of session, some of this being legal for right now, that there's only so much people can do. It would just be reassuring if they acknowledged that they're seeing it on the same level that just someone like me taking a walk in their neighborhood at night sees. Just please tell me you're seeing this too, is kind of the thought that enters my mind when I'm looking for what leaders are saying.
Yeah, even if there's not a whole hell of a lot she can do, you know, you can still be out there every day in front of the cameras and, you know, telling the press, look, this is happening, this is happening, this is happening, forwarding photos, videos, whatever, calling all of this out for what it is. And I think people would respect that and rally behind that, even though as a substantive matter, there's not really anything that Bowser can do about it.
Just saying I'm still here means something.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's fair that there's been a little bit of a leadership vacuum. Some of the council members have stepped forward and said things that are encouraging and helpful. So it's not totally dead, but it does seem like Bowser, whether this is a tactical decision or whether this is out of weakness, hasn't really pushed back aggressively on the administration in public.
Are not strong enough to make it through the noise of everything that's happening every day, not just in DC, but more broadly, and just the anger people are feeling towards Democratic leadership, especially in general, not standing up. If she's saying things, it's just not strong enough to come through all of that.
Well, thank you tremendously, Duck, both for joining us tonight and also for being out there.
Well, thanks for having me. Anything I can do to help people understand what's going on.
Yeah, and you can follow Duck at musicology.bsky.social, and also Duck, stay safe.
Yeah, I will try, and hopefully it's over in another week or two, but if not, maybe we'll check in again. But thank you for shining some light on this.
She's a lovely follow on social media when we're not being occupied. Also, it just has a different tenor.
Yeah, I want to go back to posting about music.
So we've spent 20 minutes talking about caffeine, but it's actually been kind of a fast news week that happened exclusively within the confines of the last 24 hours. We are recording this on the evening of August 26th, and a few things happened today.
Tuesday, isn't it?
Tuesday.
Tuesday.
I don't think we're going to talk about all of them. I'm not sure we're equipped to go deep on Kelsey Swift.
Though you should listen to our last episode if you have any interest in that particular news item, because Lucy did a really good job breaking down the whole Taylor Swift phenomenon. Anyhow, Proctor, what were you saying?
That was professional.
We also had some serious movement in the Federal Reserve. Specifically, about 24 hours ago, Trump published a letter on Truth Social purporting to fire Lisa Cook, who is one of the governors of the Federal Reserve. The problem with this is that under current law, he can't do that. The problem with that is that the Supreme Court has signaled quite clearly that it's going to overturn Humphrey's executor, which is a 90-year-old court case that establishes the precedent that the president can't fire certain people at independent agencies. So we have this question where Lisa Cook is in kind of this superimposed position of being both fired and still employed by the Fed right now. And that's frankly been less of a market reaction than I would have expected.
You and me both, buddy.
But I mean, that's where we're at now, right? Like, they could say that they have already deployed troops to Mexico and it would be like a, what, 0.5% drop?
Let's back up a little bit. How does the Federal Reserve work? The Federal Reserve is run by what's called the Board of Governors. The chair, who is currently Jerome Powell, everyone focuses on the chair. the chair is one of seven on the Board of Governors. They're all appointed by the president with confirmation from the Senate. They have very long terms. So Dr. Cook was appointed governor in 2022.
And then reappointed in 2024.
For a term served out through 2038. So very, very long terms. When a term is not yet expired and a governor resigns, as happened with Dr. Adriana Kugler earlier this month, she resigned her governorship and is off to teach, and her governorship was going to expire in January. So now if you want to fill that seat, you have to appoint somebody for the period through January, and then there would be a new appointee or a new term after that term expires. Okay. So the Federal Reserve, up until the Cook firing or attempted firing or attempted removal, however you want to phrase it, had, Chair Powell, his term on the Board of Governors doesn't expire until January 2028, even though his term as chair ends next May. It had Vice Chair Jefferson, Governor Barr, Governor Cook, Governor Bauman, and Governor Waller. Governor Waller and Bauman are Trump appointees who want to cut rates. Bauman will just do whatever the president tells her to. Waller is a little more of an actual economist than Bauman. So it remains to be seen how much give there is there, but he wants to cut rates right now. Dr. Stephen Miron is going to be appointed as the holdover for the seat that Kugler left. So basically you've got right now a 4-3 majority on the Board of Governors for non-crazy people. You might have a 4-2 majority depending on what Waller's votes look like, but for the purposes of cutting interest rates and doing other important stuff, it's
4-3. Isn't it? Or do I?
No, 4-3.
Okay.
Yes. Sorry. Thank you. I don't have notes in front of me. I'm doing this all off the top of my head. So, you know, welcome to our podcast. It's free. You can tell. So, the thing with Cook is if the Trump administration is able to remove Cook, then suddenly they go from a 4-3 minority to a 4-3 majority, depending on how Waller behaves. That has super big implications because there's also reporting today, for instance, that they're trying to influence the regional feds. The regional feds have input into rate setting decisions, but not other decisions made by the Board of Governors. The joint committee setting interest rates is called the FOMC. They have a meeting 8 times a year. You've probably heard that acronym if you've been around monetary policy and in any way, shape, or form. There are four regional feds and regional bank presidents. The regional banks are public-private partnerships. They have their own boards of directors who then appoint a president. It's not a public office. It's a separate thing. Those four seats rotate across 11 regional feds. One of the regional feds has a permanent seat on the FOMC, as if this couldn't get any more confusing. But for most of the regional feds, you're rotating on to the FOMC for a year, and then you have a break because the other 10 regional feds need to have their turn 4 at a time on the FOMC for 1 year. So right for the FOMC, for setting rates, there is no majority for a Trumpist take rates down 2-3% from here. None. It's not a thing because the regional federal bank president, regional federal reserve bank presidents are not Trump appointees. They have varying views on monetary policy. They might support a rate cut in September. They might not, but they're not wing nuts. However, if Trump appointees get control of the Board of Governors, they can start making changes to how the Fed operates because the Board of Governors is sort of this super committee above the FOMC. And so if Trump successfully removes Dr. Cook, Governor Cook, then a lot of stuff is potentially problematic. Full capture of the central bank is. And we don't know what would happen next, but there is real potential there for monetary policy to be run far looser than it should be relative to where inflation is or where growth is, and for inflation to really take off. And that brings us to the market reaction. So as Propter said, I'll tie a bow on this. There was a modest reaction in treasuries in terms of what's called curve steepening, which is just long-term rates rising relative to short-term rates. That happens as a correlate. It's a correlate of inflation risk because long-term bonds get hit harder by inflation. Don't ask why. Trust me on that. So high steep, that's called a steeper yield curve. If the yield curve steepens slightly, that indicates at the margin higher inflation risk. That's what we got. So it was a small move, though. The dollar had a small move that was almost immediately reversed. Equities didn't, stocks didn't, really nothing happened, essentially. So the market appears to just be saying, nah, this isn't an issue. Okay.
We're doing Erdoganism very strongly, folks.
Exactly. Good pronunciation, dude. Did you work on that?
What? Pronouncing Erdogan properly?
It was just very, it was very fast and smooth. I was impressed by that.
So to be clear, the legal issue here is not exclusively about Lisa Cook. It's about whether or not Trump has the ongoing power to fire anybody on the board of governors that he wants whenever he wants.
Yeah, because the standard for for-cause removal is some sort of dereliction of duty, some sort of malfeasance while in office. It's not, oh, you did something bad before office and then we're confirmed and now you're in office and we can punish you for that thing that happened before. That's not in the jurisprudence on this historically or referenced in statutes that use the for-cause framework. There's no like one strict definition, but this would be a radical expansion of the understanding of for-cause. If
they haven't even put forward evidence of the wrongdoing that they're accusing Lisa Cook of.
Correct. So basically what it opens up is anytime the president doesn't like someone who cannot be removed but for cause, he can just have one of his flunkies. In this case, it was FHFA Director Bill Pulte allege something on Twitter, and that's cause, and there's no restraint at all on his ability to fire people. Now, you mentioned Humphrey's executor. That was there was a case called Trump versus Wilcox where Glenn, I think her first name was, Wilcox, was an NLRB board member who was fired by Trump earlier this year. The Fed basically said, okay, here's the deal. This is fine, but the Federal Reserve, don't mess with them. You can't do this with the Fed.
And then oppositional defiance disorder occurs.
And to be clear, Humphrey's executor at this point is still good law because the way SCOTUS handled the NLRB case was through the shadow docket. What they did was they said, okay, we're not doing the merits hearing on this yet, but we are overturning the appellate court stay that said, no, you can't fire this person yet. We're saying, go ahead and fire this person, which was itself a fairly extreme move because they're, again, Humphrey's executor is still good law. SCOTUS hasn't overturned it, but they're saying, yeah, we're going to overturn it. So
I think we need to find a new term for that because the Roberts Court and good law seem disjoint sets.
I mean, it's kind of an ongoing debate right now because SCOTUS would clearly like these shadow docket decisions they're issuing. And let me define terms a little bit here. The shadow docket is when SCOTUS takes up an appeal from a lower court on a motion, on a stay typically, and says, yes, the stay can stay in effect, or no, the stay has to go away. It's not a full decision. They often don't write down their reasoning. Justices can write something on it and often do, but it's usually not as detailed or as elaborate as if they were writing an opinion. It's not precedential in the same way that a SCOTUS opinion would bind lower courts because it's a procedural issue that SCOTUS is handling with regard to that particular case. Rather than necessarily something that binds all courts under SCOTUS, which is all courts, to seeing things the way that they see it. SCOTUS has made some noises about how they would like the lower courts to be deferring more to what SCOTUS thinks they're obviously doing with these shadow docket decisions. But at the same time, like Humphrey's executor has not been overturned yet. It is still on the books. There is no Supreme Court precedent that says Humphrey's executor is wrong. What we have is a Supreme Court precedent through the shadow docket, that says, okay, in this particular case, we're going to let this firing go through for reasons that are not really expanded on. So it's,
can I ask a really dumb question real quick? Mm-hmm. Cause I want to just say that back to you to make sure it sounds as insane to everyone else as it does to me. The Supreme Court wants deference to their non-decision that they did because they don't want to make Donald Trump mad.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
That said, That said, the conservative legal establishment has been after Humphrey's executor for a long time.
It's, I mean, of
it's
course,
it's a pretty good after, bet they're going to overturn
the basic idea of literacy. What do you want?
This ties back to Dr. Cook, though, because she has said, and the Federal Reserve system has confirmed that, like in an official statement this afternoon, that she is going to seek an injunction preventing her firing. So she is operating under the assumption she has been fired. Everyone has taken as given that she has been fired. So now she's got to go to court and get an injunction against that. Some sort of temporary restraining order, something. I don't know. That process will play out in district court. It's very likely that she will be granted that injunction, both because of Humphrey's executor being good law still and because this Roberts court clearly said you cannot mess with the Supreme Court.
Gonna mess with the Fed.
So, and also because district court judges in general are not going to be sympathetic to a wildly novel interpretation of just cause.
You meant cannot mess with the Fed, not cannot mess with the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Sorry, yes, cannot mess with the Fed. Yes.
They would absolutely like you to not mess with the Supreme Court and stop saying things that hurt their feelings because that ruins the integrity of this august institution. Thank you.
Yes, also that. So it's easy to see a path here where Governor Cook goes to district court, gets her injunction, goes to the Trump administration, appeals it all the way up to SCOTUS through the Court of Appeals, be at DC courts all the way, I'm pretty sure. And then the Roberts court does exactly what they did with Wilcox, where it's a shadow docket type situation. And that process, I mean, that process is uncertain. We don't know exactly what's going to play out there, but there is a very good chance that we see something similar to what happened with Wilcox, where they don't overrule Humphrey's executor. They don't say the Federal Reserve is no longer a special little boy and has to be protected, but they still allow Cook to be fired. Either way, this is one of the most egregious attacks on central bank independence that we've seen anywhere in the world, really, certainly in a developed market since World War II, I would say. It's on par with some of the worst of this behavior in emerging markets and or frontier markets.
You know, we talked about the BLS stuff at some length the other week. That should also be understood as part of an attack on the independence of the central bank, because BLS is the eyes of the Federal Reserve.
Yep. And in both cases, the attack here is not, I mean, Trump wants lower rates. Okay, fine. The real issue is that he can't control the Federal Reserve Board. It doesn't matter what they're doing. He just wants control. And the same thing with BLS. He doesn't want an objective statistic that can be, that is unimpeachable in a way that he isn't, right? And anybody that is an objective source or a power that he cannot personally control is going to get this exact same treatment until he's removed from office or until he leaves office. It's just that simple. We're going to see this again and again and again.
It's the James Comey thing when he first got to office during Trump 1.
Oh,
and he said
right to
Comey, you know, I need your loyalty, Jim. And Comey said to him, you know, well, I have to be loyal to the Constitution, Mr. President, and fired him.
Yep, exactly the same thing. And one interpretation of how the Supreme Court has behaved this year, because it's important to say, too, I looked up some statistics for this writing my analysis this morning of everything that's gone on. And the win rate for the Trump administration going up to the Supreme Court is unbelievable. They've won all but one emergency docket move, emergency stay application. They've won all but, I think, two or three cases in general. I mean, it's the win rate is unbelievable. And this is after they're losing at an 80 or 90% rate in district court and a 70% rate in courts of appeals, right? So it's just a huge, huge, huge effort by the Supreme Court to fall in line with what he wants. And one interpretation of why they're doing that is because they think that if they actually say no to him on stuff, he will just ignore them. And that's the end of the Supreme Court as an institution. That's the more charitable interpretation. And it's not necessarily contradictory to the interpretation that they're just a shadow legislature and they actually favor all of this stuff. You know, I don't think it's a contradictory take to say that they're both happening, but it's certainly one explanation for why they're being so extraordinarily, unbelievably deferential to the president.
There are potentially going to be some problems from the other side of this also, in the way that SCOTUS is handling this case and other cases, because our appellate judicial system doesn't really have strong enforcement mechanisms. What do I mean by that? Well, let's say that a district court decides to rule in a way that is not consistent with precedent. We're getting a lot of this out of Texas, for instance. What happens? Can the higher courts discipline that judge? No, not really. He's an Article III judge. They can overturn his decision, but to do that, they have to actually do the work. They have to go take the case and overturn the case and not bounce it back to the original court of jurisdiction. So they have to actually go fix it. If we get a situation where lower courts are not complying with things that SCOTUS has done or are not acting in the way that SCOTUS wants them to act, the options for SCOTUS to rein that in are really limited. This is kind of the same administrative capacity issue that we've talked a lot about with the executive branch, where they can only be in so many places at once. They only have so much attention that they can spend. If we get a situation where there's a significant disconnect between the people who are running district courts and the appellate courts above them, the appellate courts are going to have to spend all of their time fixing those district court disagreements. So this is something that, if it becomes widespread, it's really going to be very damaging to the rule of law in this country, but it potentially provides another path to resistance if we're in a situation where the legal establishment believes that the Supreme Court is extremely co-opted.
And that's one reason I was sort of disappointed with the tack that Governor Cook and the Federal Reserve System took, because one option for dealing with this letter that was posted would just be to say, that letter's not legal. I'm not leaving my office. I'm going to continue performing my duties until you have a court order removing me.
Right.
Go get one. And instead, they're coming as the plaintiff. And I think that's a big mistake. I think that's a huge mistake tactically.
Yeah.
I'm sure they did it for a reason.
I hear what you're saying, but it sounds like there's probably a pretty good reason for doing that in the, how do you put this? They're parking National Guard on the streets.
The Federal Reserve has its own police force.
Oh, I know. Are they going to go exchange friendly small arms fire with the FBI? No. Right? Like...
But the point is, though, forcing the issue to where the Trump administration is actually the one trying to enforce law,
no, of course, I get that.
Judges trying to enforce law against the Trump administration.
What I'm saying is that you're basically asking for an uncommon amount of personal courage out of people who were not appointed for the role.
It's a tough tactical decision. That one's hard to fault someone for.
I don't think it's a lack of personal courage. I think that it's a difference of analysis. Okay. And I'm not privy to all the details of what has been alleged against Governor Cook. I'm not a lawyer also. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just a guy with a take, but I think that every statement we've gotten from Governor Cook and everything we know about the mainline view on the FOMC and in the Board of Governors is that this stuff is really serious. And the idea that taking personal risk is the thing that's keeping them from taking that approach, I am not willing to indict them for that personally.
No, I fully agree. And like, that's why I'm like, if you're going to start doing this, like, they're going to start throwing the toys, right? And their toys have three letter agencies on them. They come with flak jackets. And I think one of the things we're running into as a country is that, like, a lot of people are just kind of, they're appointed for a job. And one of the tensions we have is, I mean, like, look at Congress, right? Like, everyone's like, go do something. What? They're elected to go, like, dick about bills. They were not elected to lead the capital R resistance. And, like, I'm not saying you're saying that. Like, it's more of a general observation on people being asked to push back in really odd ways in an unprecedented time when I'm not sure other people would either.
There was a previous similarly situated appointee who took the tack that George is describing, where she said, no, I'm not fired. I'm going to show up to work. I'm just going to keep doing this. And ultimately it went through the courts and she got fired. So like, it's not a silver bullet either. I think that it's like George said, it's a tactical call one way or the other. I do think it requires some personal courage to stay in there, because I think they actually did have law enforcement come in and physically take her out of her office at one point. But these are legal tactical decisions, and there are some things that you get out of this by being the one to take it to court. You probably have more latitude in terms of choosing jurisdiction.
That's fair.
You certainly have more latitude in terms of choosing timing. You get to shape the way that this is going to play out in court in ways that you don't if you're on the defensive. Whether that's a worthwhile trade, I don't.
And that's a good point.
Probably not.
Does that matter if it goes to SCOTUS, though?
Yeah.
I mean, other thing is, whichever tactic you choose here, in all likelihood, is any of this going to matter to the ultimate outcome?
I will say, we don't know how serious SCOTUS is about protecting central bank independence. We just don't. There is clear indication that they do care about it. Do they care about it enough to risk the ire of the president? I don't know.
In Wilcox, which is the shadow docket decision we were talking about, that's kind of the twin to this, there was writing that specifically said, don't think this applies to the Fed. So, like, they've made an explicit carve-out for the Fed before, or at least the suggestion of an explicit carve-out. Again, that wasn't actually an opinion.
That the language doesn't get written unless there are at least two of the conservatives that would not approve of a non-for-cause filing. The question is, do they then try and do a King Solomon thing and cut the baby and say, well, this is actually for cause? When everybody knows it's not, everybody knows. No one's defending this. No serious person other than Trump administration flunkies is saying, yes, this is like a legitimate for-cause firing.
I don't know. That sounds like exactly the kind of thing the Roberts Court would do.
No, that's what I'm saying. The risk is that they say, yes, this actually is for cause. So what we said before still applies. You can remove her, but you can't remove anyone else. And then he just goes and does it again.
He will do it within 20 minutes.
Yes, 100%. He'll do Vice Chair Jefferson and Governor Barr and
an additional kind of subplot on this is that what Cook is alleged to have done is she took out a mortgage on a house in, I think it was Michigan, and a mortgage on a house in, I think it was Georgia. Within something like 6 months of each other.
Correct.
And in both of those mortgages, there was something that where she indicated that she was going to use the place as a primary residence.
It's standard for a conforming mortgage in this country. Not every single mortgage, but basically anyone listening to this, if you have taken out a mortgage, there was language in your mortgage document saying similar, where a conforming residential first lien mortgage loan is for your primary residence. And if you're doing it for a second home or for an investment property or whatever, you're not getting that same advantageous rate. You're getting a much higher rate or different terms because you can't securitize that loan the same way.
A, this is a pretty ticky-tack violation. This is something that happens all over the place all the time. Like,
it also depends on when the houses were bought. Like,
they were bought relatively close to. This is going to get litigated. If maybe it's going to get litigated, who the hell knows?
Okay, I wasn't sure. I didn't say it.
Based on the claims made by FHFA Director Pulte, if you take them at face value, then there is a potential issue here.
There is a potential issue. The severity of it is maybe like taking a right on red in a jurisdiction that doesn't let you take a right on red.
Correct.
Like this is not that big a deal.
The Philadelphia Fed did an analysis on a subset of national mortgage loans where they looked at people borrowing for two different primary residences in less than a year, which is the applicable thing that Governor Cook would have done. And this is something that has been done millions of times over the past decade or two.
Yeah.
It's completely quotidian. People do this all the time.
But the kind of slow burn subplot here is that the likely way that Pulte found this out is that he went and he pulled documents that he's not supposed to pull for this purpose for a list of names. So they've accused Adam Schiff of doing something similar. They've accused Letitia James up in New York of doing something similar. It seems, at least to me from the outside, it seems very likely that what's happening is essentially they're taking an enemies list and they're running it through the computers at Fannie and Freddie and saying, hey, give us all the documents you have on these people. Let's see if we can find any dirt. That's extremely illegal. You can't do that. This is, this is something that is criminal conduct in law. A speculation is that if this gets into district court, that's going to come out in discovery. So the Trump administration is going to have to come up with some way to explain how it figured this out that doesn't criminally implicate Bill Pulte, who is pretty clearly gunning for a seat on the Fed.
He's not been, his name hasn't been distributed. He's just a Trump sycophant. I mean, sycophant, not sycophant, because they're psychos. He hasn't been mentioned at all. Mirren is going to be.
That was terrible.
Yeah, no. You need to handwrite an apology to every one of our listeners.
No. I will do no such thing.
That's true. This podcast is free.
Just for the love of the game.
I will do no such thing. Pulte, I don't think is even in the conversation. I think he's just being a Trump lapdog.
He's just some clown in a suit.
One thing I will say is that one of the reasons I am confident or quite confident that Governor Cook is going to pull every lever she possibly can. Her attorney is Abbe Lowell, who, if you've never heard this name before, he has represented, among other people, Bob Menendez, John Edwards, Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump, Hunter Biden, Gary Condit, Joe Bruno. He was involved in the Clinton impeachment on the House side, the Democratic caucus side. This is not a defense attorney you get for I'm just going to do the minimum. This is the guy you bring in when you want to swing for the fences in terms of your defense. Does that mean she's going to do great? I don't know, but
Abbe Lowell is roughly the attorney equivalent of your draft pick hiring Drew Rosenhaus as their agent.
Yeah.
You're going to have a bad time.
Yeah.
I have not heard the name Gary Condit in a very, very long time.
I mean, he died in 2003, didn't he? No, wait.
When wow. But, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He was out of office in 2003. But, yeah. No, that's...
Still alive.
Oh, that's like...
He's still alive.
That's right up there with... that's right up there with you guys talking about Fen-Fen.
Welcome to the most 90s podcast you can...
And seeing as how, I don't think two of us could drive in the 90s.
Anyway, here's Wonderwall.
One hopeful piece of news that came in just as we wrapped our recording on Tuesday night is that we just broke the state supermajority in the Iowa Senate by flipping a Trump plus 11 district.
Hell yeah.
So that was a 22-point swing from last November.
Hell yeah.
Is that good?
I'm going to ask a good. Yeah, I'm going to ask a dumb question. Are we supposed to do that?
I mean, it's a real good sign that we are. But no, I mean, Trump carried this Trump carried this by 11. It was unlikely that we were going to win at all, and we won by 11. So,
yeah. And this is why I'm so blasé about the gerrymandering stuff at this point. You know, I do hope that California gerrymanders the absolute hell out of their map and, you know, by all means, Gecko, get at it. But if you're seeing a 15-point swing or even a 10-point swing, it doesn't matter what the new maps look like. I mean, there are enough swing districts that it control the House is a foregone conclusion. And I don't think we'll see a 22-point swing, but guy can dream, I guess.
I mean, that would be apocalyptic for them. But this does go, you know, I had mentioned that I was really curious to see how Iowa might shift without President Pawpaw on the ballot when we start trying to take down, like, because Joni Ernst has to run without him on the ballot for the first time, I believe.
Yeah, well, if it's Joni Ernst, there's significant speculation that she's not going to run again.
Why did you make me remember?
But yeah, I mean, Iowa could definitely be in play, and that's either a vulnerable incumbent or an open seat.
Right, right.
It might be that Ann Seltzer wasn't wrong last fall. She was just early.
Damn. She was pretty wrong, though.
She was, unfortunately, pretty wrong.
Yeah, she was. That was the worst poll I have ever seen.
why was it written in
Crayon? Anyway, so there are some reasons to hope on the electoral side that this is going to be a pretty big swing year. You know, like we said, we're not going to get 22, a 22-point nationwide swing in 2026, I don't think. But once you start getting up into the double digits, that's when Dems taking the Senate becomes real.
Unless there's like video of him in the Epstein files doing Epstein things, that's not going to be a 22-point swing.
A 10-point swing in margin nationally in the House vote is apocalyptic for their chances of holding that. I mean, and for the Senate too.
Well, there's always the other option.
Wait, what's the other option, Ed?
I think they could get 22 if he's dead.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah,
like you go into that with J.D. Vance as your standard bearer, I think that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, no kidding, right? Like that guy? Come on. So, I mean, like, and I don't watch a lot of news, but I've seen a lot of video lately. I'm hoping.
Can't rule it out.
I don't know. People are gonna like J.D. Vance. They want to vote for a guy who looks like an alcoholic divorced Chucky doll.
Yeah, but then you have to hear him talk.
The nice thing about J.D. Vance is he can be fired under the Cook standard, to get back to our Fed discussion. He can be fired for the allegation of copulating a couch. That he can be removed from that. So.
I mean, who would ever refuse to vote for Mike Johnson?
Who wouldn't vote for me?
We're trying to end this on an up note, so let's not contemplate the abyss too much longer.
I don't know. Donald Trump being carried out by four men is not an up note for you?
We're going to break out that Baja Blast flavor, Ed.
I have already promised on Blue Sky, and I will hear. I will literally go fire up the Twitch stream I have not done for mumble years, and we will be enjoying this until I literally pass out at the keyboard.
Yeah, and given how much Monster he drinks, that's a long time, folks.
Yeah, I promise it.
All right, thanks for listening this week. That's our show. If you have a chance, give us a rating and a review. Helps people find the podcast. You know the dance there. For Normal Men in Charlotte, I'm George.
In DC, I'm Propter.
In Outer Florida, I'm Low-Tax Speedrun Enjoyer.
And I'm Ed in Boston, I guess. Something like that.
He's from Maine.